once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I always get lost at this point.
We don't need to talk anymore. We've just said who we are.
That's it. Anyway, The Personal Wealth Coach is, and we need to take our clothes off here.
Otherwise known as a disclosure, for those of you that aren't as literally minded as the two bald guys.
Well, now, disclosure, that could also mean...
opening?
An unopening?
Could be opening.
A closure is an... oh, it's an unclosing.
No, it's just...
disclosing.
Right, it's just opening. It's.
But it's not disclothing.
It's kind of like negative...
well, it all depends if you have a lisp or not.
It's kind of like negative growth, where, you know... anyway, the disclosure.
All right. The Personal Wealth Coach is... an investment advisory firm registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, headquartered... now, the Exchange Commission is not headquartered. The Personal Wealth Coach is headquartered in Salado, Texas. Was that
there
cool?
There you go. Yeah. Well done.
Yeah. And the telephone number is calling here if you would like to open a discussion or close it or comment or question or something about something to do with economics, the... investment portfolios and things of that ilk, you can give us a call at 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400.
Did you like my official voice when I was talking about like the SEC and stuff?
Official voice. See, when you're talking about the SEC, one must use an official voice.
Well, if I'm being polite, I wouldn't answer that question.
Okay. Well, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Longtime listener.
Well, that's an understatement.
There's been a lot of discussion about the GDP, specifically for this country. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about derivatives, and it says that there's a $700 trillion derivatives market. I have a three-point question. What are derivatives? What is the GDP for the world, and how can... I'm sure it's not $700 trillion. How can we have $700 trillion worth of derivatives for GDP that's much, much smaller? I'll hang up and listen.
Oh, boy.
Oh,
nothing
man.
Like a really simple question
man,
to start
that
the
is,
day off.
That is, you know, what is above macro?
Okay.
You know, there's economics, and then there's macroeconomics, and whatever you just asked about was something like, it's bigger than global
we'll
economics.
We'll call it super macro.
Stellar economics or something like that.
Let's start with the first question. That's the easier one. What is a derivative? Okay. This can have a really simple answer.
Or a very complex
answer. Or a complex answer. It could have an extremely complex answer. All right. In its most basic sense, if you own a piece of property and you're the only person that owns it, you have the title in your hand. There it is. It's right there. Good job. All right. You got a piece of paper. That's not a derivative. This is a representative. It represents the entire property. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, if I have the newspaper in my hand, it's got lots of titles on it.
All right. Well, yeah, there's a lot of titles in the newspaper. You're right. Okay, so you've got the title in your hand. Now, let's say you want to split the ownership. You want to have more than one person owning a piece of property. So you can do that with partnerships. You can do that with sole proprietorships. You can just own it yourself. You can make a company, so on. So, all right. There you go. Now it's not owned by one person anymore. So the percentage ownership can be set on these documents. You're still not into derivatives. Soon as you start saying, I want the ability to possibly buy that from you. So say you own the property and you want to split, you want to give some of it to a friend. But if the friend were to die, you didn't want it to go to his estate. You wanted to have the first right to buy it.
Ah, yeah. I knew you were getting there somewhere. Okay, your first right to buy.
Right.
Okay.
That right to buy doesn't really represent any property. It's just sitting out there saying it's an agreement, saying, yeah, I'll sell it to you first. That's a derivative.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime that agreement is made, that's a derivative of the property. It doesn't represent the property itself. Whoa, my ears just went, oh, you're turning the volume. Okay.
Made it very small.
All right. Okay. All right. So anytime you have a right to do something with property, and this is another one, and one that a lot of people around here are aware of, when you sell property and you don't sell the mineral rights, Okay. Well, the mineral rights are sitting there. Say you own the mineral rights of a bunch of oil.
A bunch?
A bunch. That's the technical term. I know we get complex sometimes.
Kind of like bananas.
Right. A bunch of bananas, a bunch of oil. It's they're hanging from trees or dripping from trees, whatever. It's something. All right. Well, if an oil company comes to you and says, I would like to rent that piece of property from you, mm-hmm. and I would like to buy the ability to rent it possibly in the future, or at least get the first look. That's a derivative.
That's called an option.
Right. And options are derivatives.
And it gets more complex than that. For example, when the mortgages were all sold, and that's probably the one of the bigger derivatives that most people are familiar with, when mortgages were sold back in the boom,
When
mortgages,
the look of surprise on his face as he was in the middle of the sentence there. I wish you could have all shared that with us.
I didn't see it.
I saw it. It was like, well, that's a sneeze coming.
Okay. And so if you have these mortgages are very real things. They're loans. When they're packaged together into a mortgage bond, they're still a real thing. It's a collection of loans, but they're still real, even though there's a bunch of them. That's the technical
term. The bunch.
Assembled together. However, as soon as there is an option, and they start saying, well, if this part goes up, then that part goes down, and as soon as you start getting mathematical, what I refer to as mathematical weirdness, associated with a real loan or a real ownership. In other words, as long as there is real ownership, which we have in the various forms of stocks and in mutual funds and things like that, even mutual funds are not derivatives, you have a direct line of connection to the value of the property. And the same thing is true on a loan.
Well, I got an even really good...
A loan is an entity that exists on its own without regard to the property that might be held as collateral.
Right.
And the loan has real existence, and any direct ownership of the loan is real existence. But if you have a document that says, if interest rates go up...
Well, even better. PMI, if you get insurance that says, in the event that someone doesn't pay this loan,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to pay you. But if somebody continues to pay it, nothing happens.
That's a default swap.
Right. And that default swap is something
that's
when people hear default swap insurance, that's the sort of thing that if you don't put a 20% down payment on your home, you're required to have PMI. You're talking about mortgage insurance here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a derivative because
right.
it doesn't pay unless something happens. It is the right to pay in a certain scenario
mm-hmm.
or the right to be required to pay.
And they get pretty esoteric. And the issue is, of course, for instance, the options that are exchanged on the options exchange, which is obviously where options get exchanged.
Well, if you have the option to do that, that's true.
Options, let's say on wheat. Nobody actually, with rare exception, exercises their option to purchase 1,000 tons of wheat somewhere, okay? The guys who are trading on the Chicago futures and options exchanges, which are the same thing, don't actually buy or sell the wheat. They buy and sell the right to buy and sell the wheat, which, for whatever it's worth, expires unexercised virtually every time. Man, that is definitely a derivative.
All right, here's the next one that's a derivative, and we'll use a couple of these here real quick. You can take that a step further. If you've got wheat, at least you have the right to actually show up and say, I want those bushels. Bring them to me. Or I will pay for delivery.
Yeah, you actually do have the right to do that.
Okay.
But it doesn't pay for the wheat. It just gives you the right to buy the wheat.
Well, now there are also options on the S&P 500.
Right.
You have to recognize that the index S&P 500 doesn't actually exist as property. It's just a measurement. It's like taking an option
mm-hmm.
on the amount of
mm-hmm.
rain that falls, and there are places yep. that you can do that. Las Vegas is famous for its derivatives market. We call it gambling. there are some people that don't call it gambling in Las Vegas. There are some people that go there and consistently make money. We call those casinos. There's also professional
derivative
exchange. There are also professional gamblers that make money consistently on the amateurs.
There's a prime understanding right there. If you're in a poker game, and you make a bet, you have effectively purchased a contract that will pay off more than you paid for it.
If
a certain series of cards appear in your hand as opposed to somebody else's hand.
Right. A good way of looking at derivatives is the word if. In the event of.
Which is also a good poem.
Yeah. If is a Rudyard Kipling. Great poem.
Right.
But that word, you have the right to do something if. Now, you can buy all the rights in all the scenarios. You can buy the option to buy and the option to sell. You can wrap it all the way around and say, I have all the rights to do everything in this scenario.
And you'll lose money on that deal every time.
Because somebody's selling you those rights. So the derivative market is actually bigger than the actual market. So if we go back to something really simple like a home. Okay, you've got a home. What's the value of the home? The value of the home will be really simple and say it's $100,000. Then you have a mortgage on the home. Okay, what's the value of the mortgage? Well, the value of the mortgage is, say, $80,000. Okay, so how do you have the value of a mortgage and the value of a property? They're supposed to cancel each other out, except that...
Unless you add them together.
Except that in some case, unless you add them together, and then you get the banks do this on occasion where you say, what's the value of both your debt added to your assets? And people go, why would you want to add
it's
your
just,
debt?
It's just a number.
They use that for derivative purposes. They're looking at what the value of the derivatives are. So if the value of the house is $100,000 and the value of the mortgage is separate from the house because a bank can sell that to somebody else, they can get $80,000 plus a little bit on that mortgage.
And
you can turn around and get $100,000 on the house. These are two separate items.
If you buy a $100,000 house, and we're using this number very loosely because it's not much of a house anymore. But if you buy a $100,000 house and you pay nothing down because you did a VA loan, for example, then there is a Ginnie Mae's worth $100,000 out there. Plus, your house is worth $100,000. And if you want to add apples and oranges and go nuts, then you can say there's $200,000 where previously there was $100,000.
Which is why huge many, many trillions of dollars number comes in, because it doesn't mean anything anymore at that point.
And then if somebody says, okay, I'm going to buy options on Ginnie Mae's, so that if they go up in value, I make money, or, there's different kinds of options that can be purchased on the Ginnie Mae market or on that specific Ginnie Mae that contains yours and about a gajillion other houses.
Oh, we'll use Fannie Mae, because Fannie Mae, sometimes you can get mortgage insurance on your mortgage when you get it through Fannie Mae. That didn't used to be the fact. You used to have to do the 20% down and all of that. Mm-hmm. Well, towards the end of the market boom in 2007, it was probably 2005. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac decided that you didn't have to do the whole 20% down. So then there was a derivative inside the mortgage, the PMI that you're talking about, the mortgage insurance in there. Okay, so mortgage insurance is part of the mortgage. It's a contractual thing. So there's a derivative inside. Then people were buying the options on the ownership of the mortgage. So you've got now two derivatives on the same thing, or multiple forms of derivatives. So the derivative market got to be bigger than the mortgage itself.
And Jake said on a point here, and I think it's very important to recognize this. There's a fellow that I know who has a PhD in mathematics, which in and of itself means he's partially insane.
right.
But he is in the business of assessing risk for a major insurance company. And the kind of risk he assesses is, let's say you're going to build a big building in downtown New York or something, and you go to an insurance company and you want insurance against the failure of that building to get built. Well, the insurance company has to go out and estimate the risk in order to determine how much they should charge you for this insurance. The insurance contract itself is a derivative on the building. And derivatives, contracts, futures, all of that stuff out there that amounts to $700 trillion,
he said. I think that's what he said, yeah.
Is, and
it actually may be more than that if you add
really
them all together.
Designed originally to reduce the risk of ownership. And they are basically insurance contracts. Well, then in the process issuing an insurance contract to reduce the risk that you have of owning a house or the risk that the mortgage company has in loaning you money to buy the house, a new contract, a new document that has value was created. Well, that in and of itself, for instance, I'm going to buy a house, and I got insurance on the house to keep it from burning down or being swept away by a tornado. I mean, it doesn't.
That's a derivative.
But that is a derivative. Well, then when the insurance company issues me this this contract, this insurance contract, they take on a risk. Well, what if there is a major tornado that goes right down the middle of where this insurance company has a lot of ownership, like right through the Killeen area, right around here? USAA has a huge, what's called a geographical risk. If there was a gigantic F5 tornado that went right through the housing areas in Killeen and in right
Harker
through
Heights,
here, Harker
yeah.
Heights, USAA would take an awful hit. So they said, whoa, we're taking too much risk here.
So they buy co-insurance.
Well, not just co-insurance. They go out and buy insurance that says, okay, if this particular little group of houses ever gets blown away, the contract that we're paying for will pay us. Now,
so that's a derivative on a derivative.
And that's perfectly rational behavior, but it keeps on mushrooming out a long ways. And here's the point. The chances of that happening are very low. So when we talk about $700 trillion of derivatives,
that's the possible value of the derivatives.
What we're talking about is the fact that there is a contract sitting there that may be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to USAA if an F5 tornado ever goes through the Killeen Heights area. Well, that's where the value is. That contract is worth let's say that contract is worth $12 million.
Okay. That seems kind of small, but yeah, all right.
Maybe $100 million. It's
okay.
Worth $100 million. Well, that adds to that huge number that you talked about. Now, the chances
that
at any given moment of any of those $7 trillion worth of derivatives.
$700 trillion
worth of derivatives actually triggering and becoming worth their face value is vanishingly small.
Well, no.
And that's what it's about. That's
it's
the whole
actually
purpose.
Impossible.
Yeah, the whole system would collapse.
Yeah,
where it works.
it would simply cease to work. The whole thing would stop if something like that. It would take a meteor strike of huge proportions on the planet Earth. In which case, yes,
nothing would pay off.
Right, the $700 trillion would suddenly become due, but nobody would be around to collect it. So,
let me give you an example. If you look at the total rainfall, when the GDP is kind of like rainfall, okay.
All right, I'm going to wait for this analogy. This
now,
sounds great. All right.
Gross domestic product of the United States is the profit made by all of the entities in the United States every year. Okay.
Kind of like rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just like water falling out of the sky is, if you would consider fresh water falling out of the sky, that is the net return on evaporation in the United States.
Ah, okay. So what you're saying is that recessions are droughts.
You got it.
All right. Okay. We're taking the precipitation. Precipitously.
So if you think about the rainfall that falls on the whole world,
including Spain,
but that stays mainly in the plain.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Good. All right.
If you consider that to be the GDP of the world, okay. Now we got this.
How do you measure it?
First off, you could measure the world GDP because you can figure the total rainfall around the world. And I'll bet somebody at the United Nations has done that.
Yes.
But here's
total
the point.
Rainfall is this.
You look at the total rainfall, and then you say the derivatives markets are the equivalent of the total water in the oceans of the world, which is salt water, which can't be drunk, but it's still there, and it's still...
And it's certainly not raining it most of the time.
And you look at the quantity of water in the oceans and you look at the rain that's falling out of the sky and say, how the heck can we have so much water in the oceans?
This is why
so
we
little
said,
rain falling out of the sky.
This is why we said it's like a level beyond macroeconomics, because macroeconomics, you're still trying to...
This is like galactic economics.
You're still trying to conceptualize when these items would be used. Where when you're talking about the value of all derivatives, it's you can't really conceptualize all of them being used
because
they can't all be used. I know that this is a really esoteric area, except that it's really a basic area. If you own a business and you have a partner and you are afraid that if your partner dies, the portion of the business will go to someone else and you're going to continue to earn at the business, but half of it is going to go to somebody that's not even there. Well, then you make a contract with your partner and you say, hey, in the event of your death, I get first right to buy your stuff. I get the first right
there
to
is
buy...
There is the technical term again.
Stuff.
It's like bunch.
Bunch of
right.
stuff.
Right.
Yes. And in that event, that value is only available once. It's only there for one moment. Because at the death, if you don't have the money to buy and you have the right to do it, it doesn't help you at all. You need to have the money to exercise the right. So the right has a value that's less than the value
of the left.
Of the left. Right. Right. Left. Right.
Now,
the right to buy it has a value that's different than the value of the thing that's being purchased.
At some point in the process of economics, like in the process of physics, the ability of the human mind to comprehend what's going on there gets completely lost.
That's why we stopped being humans a few years back. We just decided to go alien.
There are mathematical issues here that only people who really understand mathematics can even begin to comprehend. Let me give you an example on the derivatives issue of why the fact that if anybody who says there's $700 trillion worth of derivatives
they
out
really
there,
don't
and
understand
that's a threat.
It. Yeah, they don't understand it.
One of my favorite guys to beat up on, Glenn Beck, in 2009 had a relatively famous show in which he demonstrated that the phenomenal quantity of money, that there were literally trillions of dollars of money being dumped into the economy by the Federal Reserve at that moment. And he said, as a result, we are about to have a collapse of our economic system. Our dollar will collapse. We'll have runaway inflation. You may have noticed that didn't happen. As a matter of fact, we had runaway inflation is what he was afraid of. We had mild deflation and
that didn't happen.
We're still here.
Wow.
Well, either he did not understand, which is, considering he's a very intelligent person, I don't know how he... Well, I don't know. I think he's intelligent. Anyway, either he had no concept of how money works and how banking works, or he was being intentionally misleading.
See,
I don't know which.
I think it's somewhere in the middle. I think a lot of very intelligent people think that they understand a lot about the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And what you find about people that understand a lot about the economy is they talk about how much they don't understand about the economy.
So how can you dump $11 trillion into the United States economy, $11 trillion extra dollars that weren't there before? I mean, they were somewhere else before they got dumped in. The Federal Reserve had them in reserve. That's why it's called the Federal Reserve. But you dump it, it's kind of like if you have so much blood in your system and they give you a transfusion of
rainwater,
of 4 pints of blood.
Can we mix the metaphors?
No.
Can we get a transfusion of 4 pints of
rainwater? No rainwater going in. Okay.
Okay.
And you would say, well, you must be about to have phenomenally high blood pressure. Well, no, actually not, because what happened is you were
bleeding.
and there's what we have in our economy is a balance between. And that's part of a free market economy.
The balance
have this,
between good and evil.
Between the fact that we
profit
have
and loss.
Tremendous amounts of risk that's being compensated for by spreading it around. And the issue of sometimes that risk gets so thoroughly spread around
that it hasn't been spread around at all.
Well, that the people involved assume that there's no risk in doing really stupid things. You know, it's kind of like if you have really, really good life insurance and really, really good medical insurance and really, really, really good automobile insurance, that doesn't mean that it's safe for you to drive over a cliff.
Well, I have an airbag.
Got it.
You know, I want to test it and make sure that it works.
Well, sometimes people think that, you know, I can make a car fly and they...
Yeah, you can. You might get it to fly for a while and then possibly the bounce is a second flight if you...
But the point is that if you believe that you could make... And this is what was happening at Lehman Brothers, is they really...
And Bear Stearns.
And Bear Stearns and at Bank of America.
Only
and
they did it through Nationwide. It wasn't really Bank of America.
Do they believe that they could take absolutely absurd risks, pass them off to somebody else, and there would be no repercussions because of the derivatives that would cover the risk?
Yeah, Alan Greenspan had a famous speech where he was talking about how he missed it, because how he missed the buildup, because what he was hoping for, what he was assuming, was that the bankers would operate in their best interest, and that would prevent them from making really, really stupid deals. Well, the bankers were just selling the stupid deals on to the next person. And it's very much like what was happening in the home buying industry, where people were coming in and buying a home, not to live in it, but to turn around and sell it for more money to the next person who bought it to do the same thing. And eventually you have to come to an end of that. We just did it on a much bigger scale at the banks, as a smaller scale as the consumer.
And then one of the great difficulties with these things is twofold. Number one, you can saturate the risk market to the point where it becomes insensitive to actual risk.
Are you saturating it with blood or rainwater or risk?
With contracts.
Okay. So it is blood, water, contract mix of saturation.
The backside to that is when people are selling things, and this is something that this is a takeaway. All this stuff we've been talking about is really esoteric. And there's nothing you can do about it. But there is something you can do here, and listen very carefully to what I'm about to tell you. When these things go on, and they go on at a very large scale, somebody has to sell them to an end user.
Yep.
A bank, an insurance company, whatever. But that's not the true end user because, for example, if a lot of these high-interest derivatives got sold to banks who said, look at all this interest we can get, and the salesman convinced them that there's no risk there, but now they've got to turn around and do something with these high-interest items, and they got to make a profit off of them. They purchased them. Now they've got to make a profit off of them. They turn around to the public, and this is – you want to know the prime derivative that you deal with on a regular basis, and somebody's going to get mad at me about
it. Here we go.
Anytime that you buy a fixed annuity, not a variable annuity, or a fixed annuity, or the guarantees involved in a variable annuity, you are purchasing an esoteric derivative because it does not directly link to the underlying value of the securities. For example, if you bought a fixed annuity and they say, we're going to pay you 4% for the next 30 years,
that's a contract with a big if on
it. And you have no idea what's in the portfolio. And when the portfolio of investments that the insurance company has rises and falls, you don't see any changes. That's a esoteric derivative that you believe is completely safe. And the reason you believe it's completely safe is they buy esoteric derivatives to support it.
Now let me say what isn't a derivative. And I've heard this called a derivative. Money is not a derivative.
True.
It is. This is, you know,
it's ownership of debt.
Right. We use money all the time, but most people don't understand what it is. It's ownership of debt. But the thing is, a dollar's debt that, you know, when you pull it out, it says Federal Reserve note. Well, that note, that's also why they call it a dollar bill, because a bill is a form of loan.
Well, is it a bill or is it a note?
Well, it just depends on the length that you hold it, I guess.
Okay, but it's not a bond.
You can hold it for 30 years if you'd like.
Okay.
It might be 10 years. Some people have held some dollars for more than 10 years.
So a dollar bill is actually a note.
Or a bond. Could be either, yes.
Okay,
it's a Federal Reserve note is what it says, but it's called a dollar bill. But you can hold it for longer, and it could become a bond.
Okay.
Okay. That is debt that is owed to you by the Federal Reserve. Okay, mm-hmm. It's signed off by the Treasury, and it has the taxing power of the nation behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So what do they owe you for that dollar?
A dollar.
They owe you a dollar for that dollar.
You got it.
So it's like the IOU that says, I owe you this IOU.
But it works.
But it works.
And well, actually, what you have is 1/14 trillionth of the GDP of the United States is owed to
15th,
you.
15 trillionth.
1/15th or 17 trillionth of the GDP of the United right. States is owed to you by the federal government. And since they can take it all, theoretically.
Yeah, if they put the tax rate at 100% right. and confiscate everything, they could have it. So that the concept of what a dollar is not a derivative. It's just debt that owes you only itself, which is a little bit weird, but it's a lot better than using chickens to buy cars, because that's right. the alternative. Or gold, which is a form of metallic chicken, if you will. if you're talking about a barter market, gold is just metallic chickens. If you think of it that way, that's a really good way of thinking about it.
The only difference is, if all else fails, you can eat the chicken.
Well, you,
or
can,
you can eat
the
gold eggs from
too.
The chicken. Not very successfully.
Thin shavings of gold. I've had it in soup. They put bouillon in soup.
But it's not. It actually has no nutrition.
No, it doesn't have any nutrition.
You would starve
value.
To death trying to eat gold, but you can eat chickens and eat the eggs from chickens, which
That's
is
true.
The interest on chickens.
That's true. Well, the problem with chickens is that the supply and the demand issue. But there is a question that if we can solve it, we can solve all supply-demand issues forever.
What's that?
Which came first? The chicken or the gold? Oh, no, or the egg.
No, the chicken feed came first. The chicken feed came first.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a good question.
The bugs came first for the chickens to eat.
And the egg ate the bugs.
No.
The egg ate the bugs.
The bugs preceded the chickens.
And the eggs ate the bugs.
No.
That's what you're saying.
No, I'm sidestepping the entire thing.
Sidestepping the issue. We could solve all the economic problems of the world with this one question, and you don't even want to try.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Actually, we could argue this one right. We are going to do some commercials which are by themselves derivatives, I think, of something. And are you know, and you can determine what's really fascinating, the reason it goes to $700 trillion is because a lot of the derivatives are leveraged.
Yeah. If you got debt on a derivative.
You got leverage. You borrow money to buy a derivatives, and then somebody loans you the money
and then they
write contracts to cover the risk of that loan. That's how the numbers get so big.
And you might get insurance on the contract that covers the debt on the derivative.
Those are called default swaps.
Right.
And it really, it's wild and crazy out there, folks. It's kind of like the weather. Okay, we're going to play some commercials and come back on the other side. This is the Personal Wealth Coach.
If you have a legal problem, then you need to contact our local expert attorney, Ed Laughlin. You'll feel a whole lot.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And here we are arguing Southwest Asian geography during the break.
Yes.
Which is
this is normal conversation between the two
very,
of us.
Very, very normal conversation. However, there was something else went on during the week besides Southwest Asia geography, which continues to go on.
It seems to go on for a long time and even further.
Do you realize in the last year we have gone roughly 500 million miles?
Yeah.
Around the galaxy.
Very, very fast.
Yes, we're circling the galaxy, and it is one big galaxy. And I was just looking that up and discovered that we'd actually traveled about 500 million miles in the last year or something
Which,
like that.
To me, it means that the lemon laws on most of our vehicles are being violated.
Right.
Because our mileage, our odometers are not reading the correct mileage.
Your personal mileage may vary.
Yeah.
And we did the whole thing while going in circles. Which is really impressive.
You'd think we'd get dizzy after a while.
Yeah,
but
okay.
No.
Anyway, and we've actually traveled millions of miles around and around the sun while we were doing that. So, I don't know. That's pretty significant to me. Anyway, something else went on during the week besides the fact that we traveled
through space.
At some astronomical, literally.
Literally astronomical.
Rate of speed, trying to make it to the other side of the galaxy, Last time we were there, by the way, was about 160 million years ago.
I don't know that anybody's trying to. I think it's just happening.
Well, the Earth seems to be trying to make it to the other side of the galaxy.
Well, that's anthropomorphism, I think.
It works.
Okay. What else has happened?
The Dow Jones Industrial Average actually was up 0.37% for the week.
Oh. Well,
year to date.
Nice.
Year to date. If you look at your statements and you see less than stellar returns, year to date, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 0.14% as of the close on Friday. You know, so that was a real big minus or plus, as the case may be. Which is, for 52 weeks, the Dow is up 7.32%. And this is, it's a nice little yardstick. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is obviously the most widely reported of the major stock indices. And people tend to pay a lot of attention to it. Now, the S&P 500 has a little different performance. It also rose. It rose a bit more. It rose 0.33 for the week, but year-to-date, it's up about 4.5%, and on a 52-week basis, it's up about 14. We are in August, in case you didn't notice that. In August, like July, is a month when the market typically declines. And the fascinating thing to me, and it continues to fascinate me, is the irrationality of the markets. The last GDP report came in around 4%, but that wasn't the big thing on an annualized basis, GDP for second quarter. If you look at it on a year-to-year basis, it's up around 3%, the GDP. But everything that's out there, and I've got a lot of data here when I could bore you to tears with it, but the CEO's survey...
Hold on, I'm crying.
...around the country, for example, says that they're more likely to be hiring in the next year than they were in the last year. And
right.
We had
that's a great
some
sign.
Pretty healthy hiring in the last year. There's a lot of things going on that indicate that we are likely to see more reports of that 4% annualized GDP during the rest of the year, barring some horrific thing. And so, of course, the market went down.
Right. There's another piece of news that came out on Friday. We talk about payrolls, and we talk about employment, and we talk about GDP. Productivity is another key factor here.
Yes.
And non-farm productivity for the second quarter, what does that even mean? It means...
It sounded pretty cool,
yeah,
whatever
I mean,
it was.
Non-farm productivity.
Non-agricultural worker productivity for the second quarter in the United States
right.
was up.
If you think that's derivatives are complicated, think about trying to measure the productivity of your average American worker as you measure in coffee breaks
well,
and everything else.
It's a pizza
else.
Cake.
It's a pizza cake.
What you did is they sold this much stuff and they paid out this much money to workers.
Right. So during the second quarter, which is when our GDP jumped 4% annualized, we had an annualized productivity gain of 2.5%.
Yay.
Well, what does that mean when you're talking about GDP? GDP, we're talking about profits. Profits are up. People's incomes are up. Companies' incomes up. All right, that's a good thing. Productivity means that we were able to make more stuff, which...
And paying less money to do it.
Right. And there's even a better piece here. Manufacturing. This is the thing that people have been yelling and screaming about
mm-hmm.
for the past several decades.
They have?
Well, yeah, they've been screaming. It's probably more than several decades, several centuries. We're
okay,
always talking
right.
about we're exporting our manufacturing jobs. And this goes back to pre-Civil War when the steam engine started coming out and the North was saying we're exporting our manufacturing jobs to the South and
got
so
it.
On.
I understand.
Okay. So then the manufacturing sector productivity was up 3.6% at an annual rate. Well,
that has pluses and has minuses.
Yeah, it certainly
the
does.
The pluses are to the corporate profits.
Uh-huh.
The minuses are that people's wages didn't go up with the production of more stuff.
Right. That's kind of the way productivity works.
Yeah.
What it means is that if we can, what we're seeing, let me take a step back. Productivity doesn't grow forever. You have, if you've got one person that's working for you, and say you're making
widgets.
Well, I was going to use widgets, but widgets will work.
Okay.
You're making
right.
widgets. One
right.
person's making 10 widgets a day.
Mm-hmm.
We'll say 100 widgets a year, even better. So they're making 100 widgets a year. Your productivity goes up by 4%. Well, now they're making 104 widgets a year. If you really want to increase your profit, you want to make more widgets, and there's only so much productivity gain that you can get out of one person. You can keep saying, all right.
Until you get a computer that makes widgets.
Right. And then you say, all right, we need a computer. Well, we need somebody to program a piece of software that will help us make better widgets. Well, you got to pay for that, which means your profits drop as your productivity is going up. Whoa, wait a minute. How do you know? Sometimes then you get a boost in profit and productivity off of that software. Well, now say the years have passed and that one worker is now making 115 widgets in a year. Well, now you either have to have new software or you have to have robots or you have to hire new people. There's a certain period of time.
You simply have a better widget making process.
Right. Well, after you've been refining it annually, year by year, trying as hard as you possibly can to make a new process. People don't, on the manufacturing line or in their day-to-day work, decide constantly, I'm going to do this a better way now, because that actually leads to less productivity. If you keep trying better ways, most of the time they don't work. So you have to take it very carefully. There's a cap on how fast that can grow. And when we're looking at unemployment and how unemployment hasn't risen as fast as the economy has, or hasn't dropped as fast as the economy has risen, it's because people are concentrating, how can we get more out of one person? Because I don't want to hire somebody and then have to lay them off if it doesn't work out. So they have been refining, exactly what you're saying, refining and refining ways of making their workers more productive. And it's the workers doing it too. They want their job. They like their job. Other people have lost their job. They want to be better at what they're doing. But there's a limit. And at that point, that's when hiring really kicks in. And what we've seen, we had a productivity drop last year. It actually dropped. And that happens to productivity after it's been growing at phenomenal rates. People get tired. And that's when the hiring really kicks in, because the bosses go, wow, I've been paying overtime. I've been having people work more hours. That's one way you can get productivity up. I have been investing in software and in robots and in computers. At some point, I have to hire or the productivity will fall.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm seeing here. So there's we can look at this and say, all right, at some point, if productivity keeps rising like that and profits keep rising faster than productivity, which is what we see, if GDP was up 4% and productivity is up 2.5,
mm-hmm.
it means that hiring has to happen, because the productivity has to rise at 4% if GDP rises at 4% if you don't want to hire people. So we got to keep hiring, which means that somewhere in there we're going to have a growth in our workforce of something over 1%.
So what are you trying to say?
I'm saying that the hiring is going to continue if the productivity
yeah.
isn't. It's growing fast, but it's not as fast as the GDP, which means we have to keep hiring.
Yeah, and there's a lot of moving parts in this particular thing. One of the things that's affecting the relatively slow recovery, and by the way, I got to run off on a little rabbit trail here.
Okay.
The Federal Reserve did a study to find out whether people... They do this household study every few months to determine, they do a survey, and to determine if people feel like they're better off or if they don't feel like they're better off, or, you know, basically, how do you feel economically you are versus before the recession?
This sounds more like a psychological experiment, but that's what the Federal Reserve does.
They call out and they do the survey. And I love the headline in Real Time Economics, which is a Dow Jones blog. The headline was, one-third of Americans say they're worst off post-recession.
Bum.
Worst off post-recession. Worst off. They're not as well off as they were in 2007.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
You read it very carefully, and you find out that one-third of Americans think they are significantly better off.
Right.
One-third of Americans believe they are about where they were, they've recovered to about where they were in 2007, and one-third think they're worse off.
Well, that's pretty much what it is most of the time.
which is why I got a big kick out of reading this extensive article focused on the fact one-third of Americans feel like they are worse off than they were in 2007.
There's another piece of this.
There
it's
is?
A big one, yeah. When this is something that's really hard for them to correct for as well. The baby boomer population is retiring. And their opinion, given just a few years ago, about whether they're better off or worse off, versus their opinion that they give today, a lot of people that retire haven't really planned for it. They're just leaving the workforce to accept Social Security, which is, you know, it's part of the reason why we get paid so much is that people actually come and use us to plan for retirement.
They do?
It's amazing, I know. But the vast majority of people don't plan for retirement.
And they don't pay us.
And they don't pay us. And when they do hit retirement,
bam.
Wham!
They get whiplash.
They definitely feel like they're worse off than they were before.
And they promptly join that 48% of Americans who pay no income taxes.
Correct.
Because they have no income.
Right. So that concept there, we have to build that into the system. There's more than just the recession that's happening. There's a demographic shift that's happening.
A demographic?
I guess it's always happening.
It's always happening.
Demographics is always happening, just like geography. And we're about out of time for this hour, though.
We are?
I believe so.
Okay. And so, I can tell next hour I'm going to discuss why housing is weak right now.
It needs to exercise.
I know, and there's a really good reason why we are not seeing a lot of new housing starts.
Well, a good exercise program to lead to less weakness.
All right, anyway.
If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally.
947-1111.
There you go.
That's the number to remember if you want to call us.
Yeah, you can also reach us toll-free. That's voicemail if you want to contact us off the air at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts. There are, you know, people often ask us how to do that. Well, you click on them, and then it will play. That's how it works.
Or
you can download it.
You can just go to our website and read the entire website.
Right. You could do that as well.
Yeah.
You can also contact us there either through email or the contact form. You can reach us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com or click contact us and you'll get right through. And I guess
we will be back next hour with lots of news.
Lots of stuff to talk about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, till next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.